Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the downsides of high intelligence. We'll spend this hour with psychologist Scott Barry Kaufman. He says having an extremely high IQ does not necessarily mean somebody has the motivation to achieve their full potential, and that exceptionally smart people are more likely than the rest of us to find their lives lack enough meaning to be satisfying. If this sounds like you or somebody you care about, take heart. We'll talk with Kaufman about how brilliant but unsatisfied people can find fulfillment, and we'll talk about some do's and don'ts for talking about kids who show exceptional promise. Our conversation starts after a short break. Obvious advantages to being naturally brilliant. Intellectually gifted individuals learn faster than most other folks. They're told from childhood about how special they are and what enormous potential they have. But if superior intelligence is such a benefit, why aren't the smartest people always the most fulfilled? How does it happen that some incredibly bright people fail to live up to expectations and end up adrift and wondering, what exactly is my purpose? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Scott Barry Kaufman is a psychologist at Barnard College, Columbia University, and host of the Psychology Podcast. His books include Wired to Create and Ungifted. He wrote recently for Scientific American about why people with high intelligence may be more likely than the rest of us to experience a crisis of meaning in their lives. Scott, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. So great to chat with you again.
I guess I've always assumed that being smarter would automatically be an advantage, but this article has caused me to question that. First of all, how does intelligence tend to shape the way people perceive the world?
Maybe all else being equal, intelligence is could be an advantage, but all else is definitely not equal in this world. And a lot of people who grow up with very high intelligence grow up, you know, they become adults. And what was shocking to me when I looked in the literature is that like only 13% of the research on giftedness is among adults. You know, it's all among children. So there's a big question mark, a big question I had that motivated my writing of this article, which is like, what is it like to be a gifted adult in the world today? And, you know, it does shape our motivation and ability for cognitive complexity to, and what I mean by cognitive complexity is to take things that may seem contradictory to each other and hold them in mind at the same time and kind of synthesize them. People with high intelligence, that stimulates them, you know, that ability to solve puzzles, to try to really get at the bottom of things, to have a great intellectual curiosity is correlated with intelligence. In fact, I view intellectual curiosity as part and parcel of human intelligence in addition to IQ testing performance. It's a really interesting question I had that I wanted to look into the literature, and that's, you know, living in this world today where there's such a fundamental lack of nuanced thinking in all different spheres, including the political sphere, you know, where's the meaning coming from for these individuals?
So you looked at the relationship between high IQ and overall well-being, but then when you drilled down, you discovered that well-being doesn't function the same way across the board.
Yeah. So in general, I want to say that having a higher IQ versus a lower IQ is, like I said, all else being equal, correlated with a wide range of positive things in life, positive outcomes. It's definitely good to have high intelligence and especially across the whole range of IQ. And you do find in terms of well-being, IQ shows a pretty strong correlation with life satisfaction, what's called, you know, what some people equate with happiness and satisfying relationships. However, there is one domain of well-being which researchers have distinguished from happiness, and that's meaning. That is much less strongly correlated with IQ across the whole band of IQ. And I keep saying across the whole band of IQ because things get even more interesting when you look at like the top 1% of IQ. And I think maybe those individuals in particular are suffering the most.
It's really interesting, as you noted, that most of the studies of very high intelligence have been in children. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, giftedness is a social construct, obviously, like in the sense that there is no I guess, 10 commandments from above saying this is what is a gifted person, you know, like we as a society, and it may change and different cultures may have different conceptualizations of who is the gifted person or the gifted child. But in America, there are gifted and talented programs which rely very strongly on the IQ test. And thankfully, they're looking at other markers of giftedness, not just IQ, but creativity as well, and leadership, and other things. The arts is also an important part of gift and talented programs. But IQ is still the predominant measure. And there's just so many, you know, there's actual program in place. There's no such thing as like a gifted and talented program as an adult. Like, right. What does that mean? Like if I, let's say I don't have a job, but I'm like, I'm gifted. Like no one cares, right? Like, like they're not going to give you special resources as an adult because you've scored high in IQ. So a lot of people gravitate towards high IQ groups, perhaps like Mensa. By the way, this one of the studies I mentioned is conducted on Mensa members. And I think that's important to recognize as well. Well, but I think that just might be one of the reasons why less research is it's harder to just like have a homogenous group of like this is the gifted, you know, in adulthood as it is in school, because there is something in place where we have that in school.
And the
does
reason,
that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does. And the reason you point out the fact that these studies focused on people who were identified by Mensa is that you don't get into that unless you think you might be gifted and you sort of self-identify and then you take the test, right? And some people who have a certain level of scoring on the Mensa test actually get into the group. So these are kind of self-selected individuals.
Self-selected. Mm-hmm. That's very, very right. But it still might be revealing in the sense that a lot of these individuals clearly feel like they're being overlooked by society. So it actually is an interesting even subpopulation of the gifted adult.
Overlooked by society. So are you saying they would join Mensa because maybe nobody would otherwise recognize how brilliant they are?
That's one way of framing it, but you know, you also find another way of framing it is just like, you know, like tribe. You know, like when you're young in school, there's this research showing that like, gifted children with a very extraordinary high intelligence, if they're put in classrooms that are unchallenging, I mean, their self-esteem really takes a dive. They're, lots of aspects of themselves, which is very conditional, are lowered. But once you put them in like a really challenging like summer camp, for instance, there are gifted summer camps and gifted and talented summer camps, things where they feel like they're, being understood, like, you know, like even the way they talk is being understood. Mm-hmm. I mean, like sometimes it can be frustrating if you know, like, let's say everyone around you is laughing at like a YouTube video of someone falling or whatever. And you're like, you know, I don't find that funny. I think that we need to rise above that and discuss the complexities of whatever. You won't be very popular.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I just think being around, you know, people that that just really accept you for who you are. And this is just a general principle in anything in life, right? It's not just those with high intelligence. But we have to treat people with high intelligence as part of the human race as well. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So like, yeah.
It's also worth noting that being identified as gifted or not gifted in childhood does not necessarily correlate to professional success in adult life, right? Plenty of brilliant kids grow up to have
totally.
Average careers. Plenty of so-called average kids have really brilliant ones.
Yeah, I am an example of that. I was ungifted in school. I wrote a whole book called Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined. But I try to separate my own research from my own personal experiences. But that is absolutely true. I mean, a lot of kids can also fall between the cracks. A lot of kids that, you know, I would argue that there were a lot of manifestations of my giftedness that were just like my creative giftedness and maybe some of my verbal giftedness that was just totally ignored and even treated as a trouble thing because I had a learning disability. So I would be careful in thinking about that, you know, even the sense that if you were not labeled gifted as a child, that you can't be a gifted adult. And I want to be very clear about that I think I've seen a lot of cases of adults who, for the first time in their lives, once they get that identity and like as gifted, even if particularly if they were never, ever referred to such as a child, it can actually be a big source of healthy identity for them to realize for the first time, like, wow, like that's why I felt so out of place my whole life. Like, and maybe there are conditions in my childhood that really blocked the manifestation of my intelligence. Like I said, learning disabilities are a big one. They really suppress IQ scores, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're stupid.
So you did find a study done in Europe that compared different kinds of giftedness. Giftedness as potential, giftedness as achievement, and then a control group of, I guess, regular people, no disrespect. What is the difference between giftedness as potential and giftedness as achievement?
We call them the control group.
Yeah.
the normal people are the control group. But okay, so this seems to be an important distinction in the field of psychology. So you can take these psychological tests and your reasoning capacity can show that you are capable of very advanced, complex thinking. But that might not necessarily manifest itself in terms of publicly recognized achievement and even in school as academic achievement, like on standardized tests. Vice versa, you can find that people can achieve academically by bringing lots of other characteristics to the table other than a high IQ score, like, you know, conscientiousness, self-control, a whole bunch of learning strategies. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that we can do, like grit, you know, is a big word these days, right? A common word. And things you can bring to the table that, allow you to still achieve even if your IQ is less than stellar. So these are we need not treat these giftedness as potential and giftedness as achievement as the same thing. They are correlated positively, but they can come apart.
Hmm. And I guess expanding the definition of giftedness to include giftedness as achievement defined by what you've done is interesting because it allows a lot more people to be defined that way.
I do. I think that's exactly right. You're always very astute, Chris. Whenever we talk, that is such a good point. It does. And Heckman, the Nobel Prize winning economist, has argued that non-cognitive traits are just as predictive of achievement, including academic achievement, as IQ, intelligence. And so it is important to recognize that this is an important source of giftedness. But so is giftedness's potential. And, you know, we can move this pendulum too much in our society where we don't want to recognize people who are gifted by potential, say, oh, that doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is achievement. And I think that's problematic as well. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. What were the most significant differences in this European study between the two kinds of gifted people by potential and achievement in terms of their motivation and their sense of meaning?
Well, achievement-oriented folks really got a lot of sense of meaning from their work and the work performance. Maybe no surprise there. Those with giftedness potential were much more driven by a term called generativity, which Erik Erikson included as a very high stage of development, where we just simply are motivated by doing things that helps others, that makes a contribution to society. And, you know, contribution to society is not necessarily the same thing as high work performance.
Right. You don't have to win Nobel Prize is different because it often is good for humanity.
Or even have high work performance ratings. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You can just find a way of sort of serving the common good and feel good about that.
Absolutely.
So why would the individuals who had been identified as exceptionally intelligent sometimes maybe be less satisfied with their work lives than folks who weren't?
You know, I think that they may feel as though they're not bringing their full capacities to the task. Mm-hmm. I think it can be a really frustrating thing to feel like you're being underutilized in some way. Or maybe you're being overutilized, maybe like just for your machinery, you know, your brain processing. Like people, you know, like everyone cheats off the smart person in school, right? I mean, not everyone, but like when you become adults, adults are still jerks, you know, like we grow up. The gifted grow up, so do the jerks. So, you know, like maybe we take advantage of the intelligent for our own benefit. And that pains me when I see that, but I do think that's a real reality.
Yeah, it made me think about people in Silicon Valley. You know, you hear these stories of like, you know, eight people sharing an apartment in San Francisco so that they can go work for these tech companies and make not very much money. They probably scored at the top of their classes in almost everything they did, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're treated as valuable contributors.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Hmm. So when the gift...
Or that they're actualizing their own autonomy and what they actually want to bring to the table.
Huh, right. So that they're doing what somebody wants them to do, but it doesn't always match with what they feel is meaningful.
Yeah, maybe it's not even contributing to society. Maybe they work in a workplace where the main goals of the workplace are constantly the bottom line, so all the achievement-oriented giftedness folks get so excited about that. But the giftedness potential folks just sit there like, wait, this is not what I want to do with my life.
My guest is Scott Barry Kaufman, psychologist at Barnard College, Columbia University. He's got an article in the current Scientific American called "Are Intellectuals Suffering a Crisis of Meaning?" If you'd like to join this conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We are at KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Barnard College, Columbia University psychologist Scott Barry Kaufman. He had a really interesting piece recently in Scientific American titled, "Are Intellectuals Suffering a Crisis of Meaning?" If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think at kera.org. Scott, I wonder, it doesn't come up specifically in this piece, but I wonder if you've looked at the way that culture and its views on giftedness affect the way people feel about their own intelligence. For example, in the U.S., we really prefer to think about our geniuses as being just freaks of nature rather than people who put in a lot of hard work. There are other places where it's no shame to work twice as hard as everyone, to be twice as smart as someone else.
Oh, you just basically answered the question. You're right. So, you know, there are also communal societies, not just the hard work aspect, but also just the communal aspect of it. Like, am I, you know, like the generativity thing, I think has a greater appreciation in some Eastern cultures. Mm-hmm. There really is, you know, you really do get rewarded a lot more in our country through achievement. Would you say natural talent is more respected than hard work in America?
It's
funny because
we say
there's a paradox there, though, isn't there? Like, we say, like, we're the pull yourself up by the bootstraps country. But when it comes down to it, the very talented person who seems to learn effortlessly gets more rewards. Hmm. So I think there's actually a hypocrisy there.
You found the studies revealed both kinds of gifted people displayed better than average self-compassion as a group than the not so gifted controls. What is self-compassion exactly?
Well, self-compassion is just viewing yourself as worthy, not necessarily better than anyone else, but worthy, and treating yourself like you would treat a friend, you know, like self-kindness. It could be a good synonym for self-compassion, you know, being mindful and aware and accepting of yourself even at, when you fail, you know, treating yourself as a friend, loving yourself in a very healthy way. But the research finding in particular showed that self-compassion was a protective factor, or offered a buffer in weakening the disconnect between meaning and giftedness. So it seems like a lot of people who are gifted, and if you have low self-compassion, that could be particularly detrimental to your meaning.
Can you think of any reason why gifted people might have greater self-compassion?
I'm not 100% sure that the finding was that they have greater self-compassion. Wasn't it that it was a moderator?
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
I'm pretty sure it was that when they had higher self-compassion, those that did within that group tended to show higher levels of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was more of a moderate. I'm not 100% sure that they actually showed higher self-compassion than the control group. So
you also write here about the Terman genetic study of genius. For folks who aren't familiar with that, remind us of how that study was carried out.
So Lewis Terman took the Binet IQ test to America and modified it and administered it to lots of people. He was very clear that genius came only from the high IQ range, and particularly only from his IQ test. So he followed up a group of kids that scored a very high percentage on his IQ test. Many years, there's some I believe they're still analyzing, like 50 years later or so, and or maybe even longer than that. So many findings, different kinds of findings have come out. Like, he, according to Terman's data, he's like, look, those with IQ are healthier, happier, like everything's gravy, you know? But then, like, other sets of researchers have started to dive into more nuanced areas of that data and kind of re-examined it. And as I mentioned in this article, one researcher who looked more closely at suicide rates found there was higher suicide rates among the sample. So not everything was just as gravy as Terman in his publicity materials tried to make it out to be.
And strikingly, the people in the Terman study who learned early in life that they were considered geniuses by somebody's measure, on average, achieved less than the ones whose gifts became apparent a little later on.
That's right. And that's the important finding there is those that sort of had to feel like they had to live up to that very high expectation. I mean, look, you're a 7-8-year-old child, and people are telling you you're gifted. What a word, right? Like, and what a high expectation that puts on you. It's not something you asked for. It's not like I asked for this attention or this expectation. And so I think that a lot of gift adults feel imposter syndrome constantly, even if they're like, it's not like they need to achieve anything. That's the whole thing with self-compassion. Huh. You don't need to achieve anything. It's not going to invalidate your giftedness if you're not achieving. Like you're still the same person. You still have the same cognitive complexity, curiosities, etc. Like just like holding that sense of self-worth is so important, especially if you're a gifted adult and you've been told your whole childhood that you're expected to have this kind of achievement.
So any particular takeaway here for people who find themselves raising or teaching gifted children? Should we avoid telling them they're gifted based on their early performance in school or on tests?
I do. Yeah. I do. I really do think we should avoid the label. I mean, the label serves a purpose for getting students resources they need, but I don't think it's that important for the students to constantly be told they're gifted. But I think, just to be encouraged, first of all, let them be children. Let them, a lot of children who are identified as gifted have very uneven profiles. So they may be able to do math 5 grades ahead, but they can't tie their shoes, or they have like their social emotional development may lag behind. And it stands out even more that your social emotional development lags behind your intelligence if there is such a discrepancy, right? So we have to just be really mindful that these are children at the end of the day, and we can help support and encourage them at the rate they want to do. I'm also not a big fan of just forcing people like just because you can solve, let's say you can go to college at the age of 10, like, should you? Does a child want to? Like, is all the child's friends at school? There are other sources of meaning in life than grade development. There are other forms of development. I know that's an obvious thing to say, but sometimes we forget that.
I don't want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. First up is Christina in Dallas. Hi, Christina.
Hey, Chris. I am so psyched to be on your show. Huge fan. I listen daily. Anyhow, I'll get right to it. I wanted to call in. I find this topic extremely interesting, especially to me. What I find so interesting is the confirmation bias aspect of it. I'm a white woman who was labeled as gifted from a very young age, and I went to a school that was predominantly Hispanic, and I saw the racial divide of the white kids being put in the advanced classes while the mostly Hispanic children were being left behind in the regular classes, despite knowing many of those kids and knowing that they were indeed gifted. So I feel like there was definitely a link between the poverty and racial divide there. And I wonder how much of like my own quote unquote giftedness is just adults telling me my whole life that I was gifted and believing in me. So I felt like I had something to live up to, whereas those other kids weren't told that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thank you so much for calling, Christina. Really interesting observations. What do you have to say about that, Scott?
Her name is Christina.
Yes.
So first of all, Christina, that was a very gifted question. So I think that you are gifted. And I don't think that takes away at all the excellent point you made, which is that there are probably a lot of other people who were as well that didn't get the same opportunities, that you probably did have a lot of privileges because, quote, you looked gifted. You fit the model or the mode of what people are thinking. This is a really serious issue. In gift education right now that my colleagues and I are trying to address is the racial ethnic inequalities in gifted education. It's still, we're talking like 98% of people identifying gifted are white or Caucasian in America. And that is truly, truly problematic. And we need to kind of broaden our conceptualization of what a gifted child could look and act like. We need to also really those who like are, quote, the trouble children can be the most creative people. So that's why in my own work on creativity, I found that once we start looking at like other markers other than academic achievement, like creativity, we actually find that ethnic racial biases are significantly decreased. And my colleague James Kaufman has also been doing some great work on that, showing that creativity is a great equalizer.
All right, let's speak next to Bernie, who's calling from Houston. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, how are you? Nice show. Thank you very much for doing it.
Thanks for calling.
Quick question for the professor. I'm curious whether or not he thinks there are any accurate or interesting or perhaps inaccurate modern cultural depictions or references, be it in movies, television comes to mind, certain program, literature about the type of child and the type of folks that he's talking about. I'm just curious what he thinks about that and what's been out there that's hurtful, helpful, or interesting.
Are you talking about stuff like Big Bang Theory, Bernie?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly what I'm thinking of.
All right, Scott, what do you think?
Oh, boy, it's a tough question for me to answer because I really don't like stereotyping. It's funny that question followed the point I just made, which is that I think we need to expand our conceptualization of what a gifted person would look like. So, like, the Big Bang Theory is an interesting example. Like, we need to broaden it from just, like, the awkward, socially awkward individual. Like, really, I mean, what that is a depiction of is you know, someone on the Asperger spectrum, Sheldon. And I don't even think it does a good job of depicting all the benefits of being on the Asperger's spectrum. So I would actually say we need to increase and broaden in popular culture both our conceptualization of giftedness, but also our conceptualization of like some kind of learning differences like Asperger's, because there's a lot more variability and what that looks like than how it's depicted.
Back to the question of the underrepresentation of people of color in America being labeled gifted, it's worth pointing out that for a very long time, all these tests were created and conducted almost exclusively by white people.
It's true. I don't know how much that biased the research. I mean, the research shows that IQ tests, for instance, are not biased against African Americans. So within the African American population or any ethnic racial minority, it still captures differences among that group, just as it does within the white population. So, you know, I wouldn't say that necessarily like a consequence of whites kind of being the ones creating the tests, that they've created biased tests, but we certainly are biased in how we use the test.
My guest is Scott Barry Kaufman, a psychologist at Barnard College, Columbia University. We're talking about a piece he wrote recently for Scientific American about whether intellectuals are more likely to be suffering a crisis of meaning. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Juan on the line in Coppell, Texas. Hi, Juan.
Hi. My question is there a correlation between intelligence and atheism? Because I believe there's a correlation between atheism and education.
What do you know about that, Scott?
There is. You know, there's no surprise that a whole bunch of these, what are called the new atheists, are just, you know, they make their whole livelihood having intellectual debates and discussions and things in all different kinds of topics. The atheism part of them is only one small part of them, but you tend to see a common pattern that there is this correlation with intelligence. But it's a correlation, you know, it's a small to moderate correlation. It's not, there are lots and lots of exceptions, but there is a correlation there. So that's interesting you picked up on that.
Okay, let's check with Ed in Arlington, Texas. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Chris. Dr. Kaufman, as I understand it, your research has identified two broad categories of talented adults. With that in mind, have you been able to determine a correlation in terms of political outlook among those two groups?
Thanks for calling.
Your listeners are not holding any punches, are they?
No one pulls any punches on this show.
Religion, politics. First of all, I want to give credit to Edith Pollitt and Tatjana Schell, who are the authors of one of the studies we mentioned on Europeans. So I just wanted to give them credit. With the correlation with politics, it is very complicated. And I don't even know if I really want to answer it, because some studies show one thing and then all the conservatives go, yay. And then some studies show another thing and liberals go, yay. And people kind of just like pick the study they want to do. I don't think it's conclusive at this point. But you do tend to find that liberals do tend to score higher on the intellect aspect of personality, like intellectual curiosity and openness to new experiences. So you do tend to find, particularly the openness to new experiences domain of human intelligence.
Are things like intelligence tests, you know, there's been so much concern recently, especially in social science research, about unintentional bias. And as you mentioned, you know, certain kinds of studies say one thing, other studies say another. I wonder how much thought researchers give to whether their personal sort of preordained beliefs about things ultimately shape the results of their studies.
Yeah, it's a great. I can't say great enough to that one because it's a really great question. Okay, so in my book, I talk about how, like, you know, all research is me-search. we really need to recognize that. So when I wrote my book on Gift, I said, you know, all these intelligence researchers study intelligence with the idea of intelligence as a particular concept in their mind, as this like fast information processing or maybe like reasoning, abstract reasoning. And I'm like, well, I'm going to put my same I'm going to say that they're biased just as I'm biased, in the sense that I think we need to redefine and think about intelligence more broadly, because I do think about it differently. So I think it's important to recognize that researchers do bring to the table their own sort of thoughts about something. But that is the nature of the scientific method, is, you know, you call it bias. Maybe someone else, maybe a scientist would just call it a hypothesis. And then hopefully you get enough different people from different labs trying to replicate it. And you do find there's a lot of serious replication issues, especially in social psychology right now, showing that that these biases definitely do exist. But hopefully we can – that doesn't mean we need to, like, get rid of the scientific method. Like, I think that it scientific method is our only hope of getting at generalizable truth. But we have to keep in mind that we have that faith that over the long run, enough different people – if it replicates, that it's getting us close to the truth, but that bias still can exist and that we weed that out when we can. So it's a very important point you made.
Yeah, and I think that's important for us in the general public who are not directly involved in doing science, because we sometimes will hear a headline and assume, oh, it's been settled. And if you ask scientists about what the results of any new study mean, they might have a much more nuanced response to it.
Oh, gosh, yes. Nothing settled. And, you know, there is something called the weird populations. Most studies in psychology have been conducted on I'm trying to memorize and remember what the weird – so it's white, industrialized, educated. You know, I forget what the weird – the part rest of weird is, Western, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, there are lots of populations that are not included in these studies, and to make these generalizable truths can be problematic in that regard.
My guest is Scott Barry Kaufman. He's a psychologist at Barnard College, Columbia University, and had a recent article in Scientific American called "Are Intellectuals Suffering a Crisis of Meaning?" He's the author of books including Wired to Create and Ungifted. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter. We are at KERA Think. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Scott Barry Kaufman, who is a psychologist at Barnard College, Columbia University, and had a recent article in Scientific American called "Are Intellectuals Suffering a Crisis of Meaning?" If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Scott, we've talked about the potential pitfalls of labeling people as gifted, particularly very early in life. I wonder, though, in terms of official identification of like genius-level cognitive ability, it would seem that most people who are exceptionally intelligent would know this about themselves without being told. Is that not the case?
I think that is the case. I think the only, you know, when people who like seek out mensa, I mean, I think are seeking out for a reason, you know, like maybe they're not feeling like they're getting sources of self-esteem in other areas of their lives. You know, people who are out there, you know, contributing feeling like they're having opportunities to contribute to a field or something and utilizing their intelligence tend to not be preoccupied with what is my intelligence or trying to show others what their intelligence is or labeling it, putting a label on it. I think that is absolutely correct.
Hmm. All right. Back to the phones now. Liz is calling us from Austin. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Chris. Scott, I'm pondering what Joseph Campbell said, that we have a meaning of life until we get a better meaning. And so this suggests that as we go through the life cycle and accrue wisdom and meaning, that there may be a crisis in using the most of one's skills to find transformative meaning and have a profound impact in society, especially if a person has high ability in multiple domains. And I'm wondering what your research has shown.
Thanks for calling.
What's the quote? We find meaning until we find more meaning. What was the exact quote?
We have a meaning in life until we get a better meaning. In other words, the moment we're popping off the planet, we go, oh, so that was the meaning of life. And maybe somebody feels that they missed the point,
yeah.
You know?
I love that. I really do love that quote, which I've never heard before. So thank you. I'm a big Campbell fan. So psychologists distinguish between different kinds of meaning. Coherence is a form of meaning where you're like, yeah, things in my environment pretty much make sense. You know, like I have some predictability. You know, I go home and I have a family and there's coherence there. And they distinguish that from purpose, which is having some higher order goal. And that kind of, it's a self-organizing goal. It can reorganize, you know, everything in your life once you like find or discover that this goal is right for you. And I think that Campbell quote is just so much in line with research showing that when people do discover a higher calling, all these things that seemed to matter than before or that maybe were meaningful than before suddenly don't matter as much anymore, nearly as much anymore, as all the energies of the self now get directed towards a higher purpose.
Does relative intelligence, to the extent that it can be measured, does it affect who people tend to socialize with?
Does relative intelligence affect...
Do people tend to socialize with people who are about as intelligent as they are?
Yes, but there's also a whole bunch of other dimensions that people socialize with. So yes, again, that's one of those like all else being equal mm-hmm. sort of things. It's true, but you know, like narcissists tend to like narcissists. Like, yeah, I can go down the list of all these different individual differences. We tend to gravitate toward compassionate people. Tend to, you know, like you know, we'll all join like volunteer groups together, mm-hmm. and it might have all different various things of intelligence. I actually think the world is a better place if we don't just socialize with people of our own intelligence levels, actually. Like, I would make the case that cognitive diversity is really important and just all different kinds of minds and perspectives and different sources of ways that we can differ from each other should be appreciated as well in terms of who we choose to hang out with. But I did mention that study, you know, in childhood, particularly when you're in this very, and like I said, childhood in particular, where you're in this microcosm of reality where like the only thing that seems to really matter is school, you know, from K to 12. It is very, very helpful to be able to be challenged with others who also are ready for the same challenges.
I wonder if something has changed in our culture. It seems as if our obsession with deciding just how smart very young children might be or what their intellectual potential might be is a new-ish phenomenon, right? Like, I don't know that I've seen copies of John F. Kennedy's report cards from elementary school and he was making C's and he was smart enough to become president of the United States, but it didn't seem like it was necessary in the early part of the 20th century to decide so early on how far people might be able to go.
Totally. Again, like I write about so much of this in Ungifted about how many people fall between the cracks because, again, like this emphasis on achievement within this very narrow band of achievement, like, you know, like the curriculum that we are going, that we as teachers or administrators are going to say are the most, that they should be the most important things in your lives. And that is really problematic because most people are capable of self-actualizing in their own direction. And that often does not align with the very narrow curriculum we've said is the most important thing.
That's really interesting. So in other words, being great at school doesn't necessarily make you great at career or life.
Totally.
Yeah. All right. Let's speak now with Sean on the line in Dallas. Hi, Sean.
Oh, hi. I think our not only our guest here is gifted, but I think you're gifted too, listening to your Think program so much. But
hey, that's very kind of you. I just work hard, actually, but please continue.
Well, I know you do.
No, I'll take the gifted label, though. Not joking.
Yeah, there you go. Hey,
thank you.
My son was actually listed gifted and everything, and just so everybody knows, if you have a child that's listed gifted in school, you're actually entitled to federal protection. You want to make, you know, they have to cater to you in a sense. But one of the things, though, that I did run into, I think it was a study where it said that 80% of the children that are labeled gifted are actually the older children that are in the class.
Hmm.
You know, in other words, they were... you know, they didn't make it in because of maybe a month or two, you know, being too young. And I'm just wondering if you knew anything about that. And it would make sense because they'd be probably more mature.
Thanks,
you know,
for calling.
To the next grade.
That's really interesting.
I'm not aware of that specific research because intelligence is usually normed on your own age group. So you're only compared to people within your age group. I'm just not familiar with that particular finding. Sorry.
Okay. Let's speak with Leah calling from Carrollton, Texas. Hi, Leah.
Hi. I was just on a lunch break and I was flipping through the channels and this just caught me because I feel like it is a, like, just description of my whole adult life so far. Everything y'all have been saying has been my life in my 20s since I graduated high school. And when I was in school, I was categorized as GT, gifted, talented. And back then, it used to be, like, who I was. It's what I identified as, and I just reveled in it. And I expected my life to be a certain way, and then I have just floundered through everything, and part of that I've caused myself my own just heaps of grief and depression because I have never matched up to my own expectation of my own potential. Everybody else thinks I'm doing great and everything, and, oh, you're successful at this, you're successful at this, but in my mind I'm thinking of all the things I did wrong and how I could have done it better. And done it bigger and been more important, and you were a GT student, and why aren't you doing better? And it's just caused me a lot of anxiety. I think you can tell from my voice, probably. Anxiety, depression, and stuff. And I've got bits and pieces of the show. I'm sorry if you've addressed this already, but I just want to know how big is the correlation between your anxiety, depression, and your expectations set out for yourself by being categorized as gifted and talented.
Leah, I'm glad you called. And before we let you go, did you say you were in your 20s?
Yes, I am on the tail end. I am 29. Well, I will be glad to leave them behind.
Before we get Scott's answer, I will say 29 is still really young. There's still lots of time for you to become who you're supposed to be, but we'll get a professional's answer to your question. Thanks for calling.
No, you're spot on. And like, I want to say that, like, you're not alone. This is why I'm so glad that Chris allowed me to talk about this topic, because so many people are so many intelligent, but all of us, you know, like, become an adult and feel like we're not living up to maybe some of the higher expectations that were set us when we're younger. And I think a key of this study is showing that a real important factor here is self-compassion. And I would recommend you to listen to some of Krista Neff's free meditations on her website for self-compassion. She even has like a whole like retreat that you can go on. But it's very transformative to a lot of people. to realize, like, you know, I'm really worthy as I am right now, and kind of stop putting so much of this extra pressure on yourself that is really unnecessary.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's interesting, Scott, when you talk about something like that, because I think a lot of people think, well, if it were that easy, I would just tell myself not to be so hard on myself. But it sounds like it takes a little work to actually get to the place where you can practice self-compassion if it doesn't come naturally.
Oh, gosh, yes. There are so many defenses that we are just naturally erect, and it can take sometimes a lifetime to I want to give hope to people that don't have to wait their whole life to get there. But, you know, I think the important thing is start reframing your life as like I have set goals, then I'm supposed to achieve things at certain times, as just like a whole journey of growth. Like, that's just my life is going to be a continual growth. And it does take a lot of work and can be done, you know, mindful practices of self-compassion over just a couple months. You can start to see real changes in the way you think about the world and yourself.
You and I have talked about this on the show before, but it's been a while. As a kid, you had some learning disabilities. You were not in the gifted classes. You grew up, recognized your own potential, became a PhD. You write books. I wonder how you think about your own intelligence today, Scott.
Wow. So you remember our conversation?
I do. I think it was 2012 or 13.
I'm so honored. It was a while ago. so honored. I certainly do. I love talking to you. Yeah, so I guess I've thought differently about my own intelligence, in the sense that when I wrote on gifted, I was very anti the label gifted, and I had this kind of reaction that I feel like you even had with one of the guests saying, "Well, no, I just work hard," you know, like almost like it's a narcissistic thing to say I'm gifted. And I had a friend who's a neuroscientist a couple years ago was like, "You know what? I'm going to scan your brain and test your IQ, and we're going to see what's up as an adult." And we found out that my total IQ score was a little bit above average, but not in the gifted range. So, if you only looked there, and that's where the only place people looked in my childhood, you would miss out on the real nuance. And you look at the subscales, it turns out that I had I have this 3D mental rotation deficit, like where I'm really bad at like directions and like reading maps and blocks and things. And I'm really so bad at that suppressed the fact that I was verbally gifted, according to his test. This is something that, like, no school psychologist took the time as a child to look deeper at the deeper aspects of me. They looked at just this total, like, summary score of a human.
Yeah.
And so nowadays, I actually I don't view hard work and giftedness as mutually exclusive. I'm like, you know what? I probably have some gifts that I'm privileged to have, and I also work darn hard, you know, like extremely hard to try to actualize them to the world. I no longer have as much of that low self-esteem and imposter syndrome that I had as a child.
I'm so glad to hear that. When you look at the research that already exists about giftedness, what do you find missing? What other studies would you like to see conducted?
Oh, boy. Well, creativity is a big interest of mine. I think that you have a lot of creatively gifted. There's different kinds of giftedness. Mm-hmm. So I think that we can – what about what we're talking about today with IQ and intellectual curiosity? I would just call it intellectual giftedness. But there's also creative giftedness, like people who – and sometimes that can be the opposite of intellectual giftedness, like people who think so divergently and aren't really good at like concentrating and solving abstract set puzzles, but they're really insightful. You know, there's artistic giftedness. There's a whole wide range. There's leadership giftedness. There's also, finally, I just want to say that something I think has been neglected is just, you know, like love, like those who are gifted in compassion and that empathy. And that's so important in the world today.
Scott Barry Kaufman is a psychologist at Barnard College, Columbia University, and host of the Psychology Podcast. His books include Wired to Create and Ungifted. He wrote recently for Scientific American about intellectuals experiencing a crisis of meaning in their lives. Scott, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think and subscribe to our podcast using your favorite podcast app. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.